Chapter 8. The Informant. 1. On a warm, breezy day in early March, Bruce was sitting at his desk and enjoying his coffee as he opened the Daily Mail for the store, something he still insisted on doing after almost 24 years. He also insisted on opening each of the countless boxes of new books that arrived 3 times a week. He loved the smell and feel of each new book, and he especially enjoyed finding the perfect place on the shelves for each one. And he habitually boxed up all the unsold books and sent them back to the publishers as returns, acts of defeat that still depressed him. A plain envelope, light lemon yellow in color, was addressed to him at Bay Books on Main Street in Santa Rosa. The address was typed in all caps on a label, and there was nothing for the return. It was postmarked in Amarillo, and at first glance, it looked like nothing but junk mail, and he almost tossed it in the wastebasket. Then he opened it. On a plain yellow sheet of paper, the sender had typed, "The last person I talked to about this was Nelson, and we know what happened to him. Do you think we should have a conversation?" Attached to it was a yellow index card with the message, "Crazy Ghost is a chat room for anonymous mail. Cost $20 for a month, credit card. The address there is 3838 Bevel." Bruce placed the letter and the card on his desk, took his coffee cup, and went upstairs to the cafe and rinsed it out. He dried it, poured another cup, stared out the window, spoke to no one because the place was deserted, and went back to his office. He went online, couldn't find anything, and walked to the front cashier and asked a 20-year-old tattooed part-timer about the site. In less than 3 minutes, the kid, without looking up from his screen, said, "It looks legit. One of the private chat rooms from overseas, either Singapore or the Ukraine. There are a bunch of them, and they burn the messages 5 to 15 minutes or so after they're put up. $20 a month." "Would you use it?" Bruce asked. "You don't pay me enough." "Ha ha. In other words, what do you do when you want complete privacy?" "I use sign language. Seriously, I assume nothing is private on the internet, so I post only what I don't care about. Texting is a bit more private." "But you wouldn't be afraid of this?"
"Probably not."
"You laundering money again?" "Ha ha! This from a 20-year-old kid. No respect." Bruce went to the site, paid with a credit card, and said hello to 3838 Bevel. "Bay Books here. Anybody home?" Got the message. 050 Bart Starr. 15 minutes passed, there was no answer, and his message vanished. He waited half an hour and tried again with the same result. With meaningful work now impossible, he puttered around his first editions room and tried to appear busy. He got a response on his third attempt. "Bevel here. What was Faulkner's last novel?" "The Reavers." "And Hemingway's?" "Old Man and the Sea." "Styron's." "Sophie's Choice." "Did Nelson's last one have more than one title?" "Don't know." "Pulse is a nice title." "The book is pretty good, too. What's our risk here, on this site?" "Are you a techie?"
"No, a caveman."
"We're safe. But you can assume some nasty folks are watching you."
"Same ones who got Nelson?"
"Yep. Put nothing in writing. Assume they're listening to your calls."
"This is pretty intense."
"So are they. Look at Nelson. Gotta run. 2 p.m. tomorrow." Bruce stared at the screen until the entries faded. When it dawned on him that they were indeed gone forever, he scribbled down as much as he could remember. He left the store and walked to a wine bar where he ordered a seltzer water and pretended to read a magazine. He decided he would not tell Noel until later. It could be a significant moment in the Nelson mystery, or not. No, it had to be significant. Little progress was made the following day during their second exchange. Bruce asked, "Why the letter?
We need to talk, but not sure if we can.
About Nelson?
You catch on fast. Look, if you want to talk, then let's do it. So far, we're just dancing.
That's probably safer.
Do you know who killed him?
I have a pretty good idea.
Why keep quiet?
Oh, that's much safer, believe me.
Now, there's another dead body.
Am I expected to respond?
A young lady in Kentucky.
Again, I'm treading water.
Better go.
Same time tomorrow.
Bruce tried to print the exchange, but the site wouldn't allow it. He quickly scribbled down the words.
The following day, Bevel was a no-show. Same for the day after. Bruce did not want to alarm Noelle, so he didn't tell her.
2. 2 days later, Bruce flew to Washington Dulles and went to his hotel room near the airport. 3 hours later, Nick Sutton arrived by car and brought a girl with him, which Bruce had not anticipated. Nick assured him she would not get in the way and had family in the area. After a leisurely semester abroad in Venice, Nick was drifting through his final weeks at Wake Forest and claimed to be in a funk at the prospect of leaving college. Bruce had little sympathy and told the kid it was time to get off his ass and find a real job. Not the usual summertime bookstore gig where he split his time between reading crime novels and stalking college girls on the beach. Nick wanted to write fiction for a living and do it the old-fashioned way, with a big advance that allowed him to work at a leisurely pace of a few pages a day, before long lunches and plenty of booze. His dream was to become a famous writer and hellraiser at a young age, much in the tradition of Hemingway, Faulkner, and Fitzgerald, though he planned to put aside literary aspirations and write mysteries that would sell. Bruce thought he had talent, but was already worried about his work ethic. They quickly retired to the hotel bar and ordered sandwiches without the girl. Bruce summarized the developments in the state's investigation, of which there were few, and described his own efforts to solve the crime with Alpha North Solutions. Nick loved the idea of hiring a secretive security outfit to handle an investigation that the police were in the process of botching. Bruce wanted him in the room because, so far, his instincts had been near perfect. And because he was only 21, he was far tech-savvier than Bruce could ever hope to be. Bruce showed him the transcript of the two exchanges with 3838 Bevel.
"A huge step in the right direction," Nick said with a satisfied smile. "This is our guy, the snitch, who knows it all and contacted Nelson with the goods. Beautiful."
"But he's gone silent. How do we get him back in the loop?"
"Money. That was his motivation to begin with. How much did you get for the novel?"
$300,000.
"Has that been reported?"
"No, but the sale has. Bevel certainly knows there's a book deal."
"And Bevel wants the cut that Nelson promised. He's not going away, but he's also afraid of his shadow."
"So what's our next move?"
"We wait. He'll contact you because he needs you, not the other way around. Your goal is to solve Nelson's murder. If you fail, your life goes on unchanged. He ain't your brother. But Bevel here wants the money Nelson promised. For him, it's a definite game changer."
3. Promptly at 9 Friday morning, Bruce and Nick entered the nameless mirrored tower where Alpha North Solutions hid itself. Lindsay Wheat met them at the elevator, and Bruce introduced Nick, who drew a look with his faded jeans, battered sneakers, colorful t-shirt, and oversized sports coat with tattered elbow patches. "Nick here was a friend of Nelson's, and was with me when we discovered his body," Bruce said, almost apologetically, though he didn't care if she approved or not. He was paying her. They followed her to her office, with Nick soaking up all of the surroundings, what little there were. The interior designer who outfitted the place had apparently been ordered to avoid all color and warmth. They gathered around a small conference table and prepared their coffees.
Bruce cared little for chit-chat, and when Lindsay asked Nick for his plans after college, Bruce said, "Look, let's skip the preliminaries. You have news, I have news. Let's get on with it." She smiled and said, "Indeed." Then she picked up a report, adjusted her reading glasses, and began. "We infiltrated 3 nursing homes in rural Kentucky, one owned by Fishback, one by Grattan, one by Packline Retirement. As you know, Fishback and Grattan are privately owned and have deplorable compliance histories. Packline is the worst of the publics. More about them later. We started in Flora, Kentucky, a backwater little town of 3,000, and quickly managed to sign up a couple of employees. The first was Vera Stark at Glen Valley, the Fishback facility. I handled Vera myself and slowly brought her along. She provided the names of the advanced dementia patients, the non-responsive ones, more commonly referred to by staff as nons, as I have learned, along with several other non-flattering nicknames. After she gave us the names, I convinced her to research the types of formula and meds that are tube-fed to the patients. Because the place is perpetually understaffed, Vera began volunteering to handle the feedings, something that is not unusual. The syringes are usually loaded in the pharmacy and given to the staff on duty, but security is not tight. Rules and procedures are not always followed. She lifted a new syringe, brought it to me, and I ordered a box of the same. We loaded a substitute with the same formula, and Vera agreed to swap it with a real one. Over the course of 2 weeks, she made about 3 dozen swaps from 4 nons, giving us plenty of samples to analyze. The bottom line is that there is nothing suspicious being administered to these patients, not at Glen Valley. As far as Vera could tell, the meds are always given with the feedings, 3 or 4 times a day. She also noted that the nons received much better care than the other patients. Plenty of calories and water, cleaner beds, hourly turnings, and so on. Gotta keep them alive, you know. Meanwhile, a colleague named Jumper was handling a young lady named Brittany Bolton, an orderly at Serenity Home, a Grattan facility across town. Brittany's story became far more complicated because she planned to be a star witness in an abuse case. Seems she saw one of her co-workers raping a young lady who's been brain dead for a long time. Brittany claimed the girl was pregnant, and she was probably right. Brittany did the same syringe swap and gave us over 40 samples from 7 different patients. Our lab technicians here in D.C. found the usual concoction of various formulas and meds for blood pressure, diabetes, dementia, blood clotting, blood thinner, blood thickener, pretty much the entire menu, plus some vitamins. And then they found something they could not identify, a mysterious ingredient that was neither food nor vitamin, and it appeared in all 40 samples Brittany lifted from Serenity. Our scientists ran test after test, but got nowhere. So Jumper went back to Brittany and said we needed more. We needed to get inside the pharmacy. This would take time. I moved on to the third facility, a Packline retirement home in an even more rural area about an hour from Flora. I made contact with a 20-year-old newlywed father with a kid working for $13 an hour. Because Packline is a public company, its pay scale is slightly better. He needed cash and took the deal. We eventually got samples from 5 nons and all checked out. Nothing suspicious. Back to Brittany. She volunteered to work double shifts so she would be on the floor late at night. We gave her a list of every medication and vitamin that the labs had identified so far, and she memorized it. She already knew most of the meds anyway. Without creating suspicion, she managed to learn her way around the pharmacy and realized that she could leave with certain over-the-counter items, aspirin, cough drops, Band-Aids, and so on, almost any time she wanted. Because of staffing issues, she told her supervisor that she was willing to learn how to handle the food and meds for the feedings. Eventually, she walked out with a jar of something called vitamin E3, a generic-looking capsule that could pass for almost any supplement. Don't know how much you know about vitamins, but there is no such thing as E3. It sent off alarms in the lab and went through every possible test. The bottom line is that it's an obscure drug called Flaxacil, one that's never been on the market. It's never been approved anywhere because no one has tried to get it approved. The story is that it was accidentally created as some byproduct in a Chinese lab 20 years ago and was tested on a few human guinea pigs over there. It was dropped immediately when they realized that the drug causes vomiting and blindness.
That would pose a challenge for marketing, even for a drug company, Bruce quipped, but it fell flat.
Apparently, it's an easy drug to make and is produced only on demand.
So what does the drug do? Bruce asked.
Keeps the heart beating barely, but only in people who are practically brain dead anyway. It stimulates the medulla, the lower half of the brain stem that connects to the spinal cord and controls our involuntary functions, like breathing, heart rate, swallowing, blood pressure. Pretty important little area.
Nick added,
it also causes vomiting, which explains that side effect.
Correct.
And no one knows the patients are blind because they can't open their eyes, right? Bruce added.
Exactly.
Nick said,
so Nelson was onto something.
He certainly was.
He knew about this drug, and the only way he could possibly learn of its existence was through an informant, someone with deep connections at Grattan.
Thought so,
Nick said almost under his breath. He shot a quick, smug smile at Bruce, who could only shake his head. And what happened to Brittany? Bruce asked. Lindsay slowly took a sip of coffee while staring at Bruce.
Do you know what happened?
Yes, I do.
And the question is whether you plan to tell me.
Yes, I was going to tell you. She's dead.
Opioid overdose, according to the newspaper over in Kentucky. You believe that?
No, not really. It got real complicated, and it's far from over. We're done, but the plot thickens. Evidently, there was a surveillance camera in the pharmacy that Brittany did not notice. She was seen lifting the vitamin E3 along with other medications, maybe pain pills, maybe not. We really don't know. They kept a fair amount of the heavy stuff in the pharmacy, but usually under lock and key. If Brittany lifted the opioids, we didn't know about it. There are a few cameras around the facility, but hardly anyone to monitor them. A colleague named Gerard, a real character, had access to the cameras, and he had noticed Brittany's new and sudden interest in the pharmacy. It appears that Gerard doesn't miss much. He kept the footage for future extortion. He and Brittany despised each other. Not long afterward, she caught him in the room with the pregnant patient, and they had a huge fight. She accused him of getting the girl pregnant and threatened to tell a lawyer. He accused her of stealing meds and said he had the video to prove it. He showed the video to the director, and Brittany was fired on the spot. 2 days later, the pregnant girl died of complications. Brittany was certain that Gerard juiced her with a mix of drugs. Her body was immediately sent to her mother in Ohio and buried quickly. The lawsuit was gone. The company then knew that Brittany had lifted some E3, although at the time our lab work wasn't finished and we didn't know about the drug. Neither did Brittany. Jumper suggested that she leave town for a spell, and we even offered to send her away. She was thinking about this when she died.
And she died how?
She was in a crowded bar last Saturday night, drinking heavily, and apparently someone spiked her drink. From there, we don't know. Her body was found in a ditch behind the bar. Official cause was too much oxycodone, which is hard to believe since she was drinking and partying with friends and not swallowing pain pills. My guess is that someone grabbed her as she was fading, injected her with a massive dose, and left her for dead.
The same people who killed Nelson, Nick said.
Lindsay nodded in agreement, but said nothing. Bruce said, so, in a way, we're responsible for her death.
I disagree, she said. no more so than Nelson's. The people doing the killing are running scared and trying to hide dirty secrets. They knew Brittany filched the E3, and they could take no chances. They also knew that Nelson knew, and they wanted to silence him.
I'm sorry, Bruce said, but I feel some level of responsibility. You assured me that you do not break laws.
Look, Bruce, in this line of work, we often operate in the gray areas. We didn't steal the bottle of E3. Rather, we borrowed it and then took it back.
Bruce exhaled in frustration, stood, and walked around the room, obviously bothered. Lindsay watched him with a tight, smug smile, as if she had no concerns. He would come around because he had no choice. Finally, Bruce said, I don't buy it, Lindsay. I'm sorry. Those two girls are dead because of our, what do you call it, infiltration.
Our hands are clean, Bruce, she replied coolly, completely unruffled. The patient had been brain dead for years. If she was raped and impregnated, that's hard to pin on us. As for Brittany, we had nothing to do with her murder.
How can you say that? We had everything to do with it.
Under your scenario, she was murdered because she swiped a bottle of their secret drug, one that they are evidently quite touchy about. And she borrowed the E3 at your suggestion and direction. You were paying her. That implicates the hell out of us.
She was sloppy, Bruce. Jumper warned her repeatedly about surveillance cameras, especially around the pharmacy. She got herself caught on video while she was stealing for you, for us. I can't believe this. Nick, help me out here.
Nick shrugged and raised his hands in mock surrender, said, I'm just a college boy, and right now, I'd love to be back on campus. What am I doing here?
Thanks for nothing, Bruce shot back.
Don't mention it.
Lindsay, eager to control the narrative, said,
We are not implicated because we committed no crime, and nothing we did in Kentucky can be traced to us. As I promised you up front, we are very careful, and we know what we're doing. Brittany was handled in a proper fashion, and she simply missed a surveillance camera.
So let's blame her for getting herself killed, Bruce said.
If she had noticed the camera, she would probably be alive.
I'm not believing this.
Bruce was standing in the window, peering through the blinds, talking over his shoulder. Nick cleared his throat and asked,
Is her death being investigated?
Yes, sort of. There was an autopsy, but I don't know the results. If they find traces of club drugs, they'll know they've got a problem.
Club drugs?
Bruce asked.
Nick said, Roofies, GHB, ecstasy, Special K, the usual date rape stuff.
Jumper says there's a rumor that a witness saw her outside the bar with a stranger. Who knows?
It's hard to have confidence in the local boys in rural Kentucky.
Nick said,
Well, we've got the Florida State Police on the ball, and they haven't made it halfway to first base.
We had nothing to do with Brittany's death, Lindsay said defensively.
You keep saying that, Bruce said, still talking to the blinds. Who are you trying to convince?
You know, Bruce, I'm a bit perplexed by your tone and attitude. We are in a gray area here, and that's often where we are forced to go. Need I remind you of where you were 3 years ago when our company first met you? The stolen manuscripts? You were so far out of bounds, you weren't even near a gray area.
What happened 3 years ago? Nick asked.
None of your business, Bruce snapped.
Just thought I'd ask.
Bruce suddenly turned around and took a few steps toward Lindsay. He glared at her, pointed a finger, said,
Your company is fired as of now. Close the file and keep the change. Don't lift another finger on behalf of me or the estate of Nelson Kerr. Send me a termination letter.
Come on, Bruce.
Let's go, Nick.
Nick jumped to his feet and followed Bruce through the door. Lindsay Wheat kept her cool and took another sip of coffee. 4. Nothing was said as they drove the 7 minutes to their hotel. Nothing was said as they entered it and walked through the lobby and went straight to the bar. Both ordered coffee,
though both really wanted a drink. Nick managed to keep quiet and knew that Bruce should speak first. When the coffee arrived, both ignored it. Finally, Bruce rubbed his eyes and said, "You think I'm wrong?"
"No. There's something about her I don't like, and I'm not sure she would ever tell the whole story."
"We don't need her anymore, Nick. That's one reason I walked out. We know the name of the company, the name of their secret drug, and the informant has made contact with me. We never told Miss Lindsay about the secret messages. We debated that, and thankfully we didn't say anything. She'd probably screw it up or get someone else killed, probably me. They almost got Mercer hurt 3 years ago."
"Then why'd you hire them?"
"Because they're good. They found the drug, Nick. Who else could have done that? The Florida State Police? The yokels in Kentucky? Not even the FBI, because they have to play by the rules."
"Are you going to tell me the story?"
"I'll tell you part of the story, and if you ever breathe a word, I'll take away your employee discount."
"It's only 20%. At Barnes & Noble, it's 40.
"I can't do this over coffee. I need a drink."
"Me too."
Bruce walked to the bar and brought back two beers. He took a mighty gulp and smacked his lips. "You remember when the Fitzgerald manuscripts were stolen from Princeton about 4 years ago?"
"Sure, big story. Somebody paid a ransom and the thieves returned the manuscripts."
"Something like that. The stolen loot was on Camino Island. It's a long story."
"For this, I have all the time in the world."
5. In the normal scheme of things, Camino Island came to life each year in the middle of March when students on spring break headed in droves to Florida. They took over the beach hotels and condos and summer rentals, and they drank and danced and frolicked on the beaches because they were 19 years old and weary from the rigors of study. Daddy could afford it. Daddy was told it was simply part of the entire college experience, and Daddy himself had probably been drunk and sunburned for an entire week back in the day. But the island was still wounded, so the parties went farther south. A few hotels had reopened, but there was construction everywhere. The last thing the recovery needed was 25,000 young idiots loose in the streets. Quietly, the island advertised that it was not yet open for business. "Come back next year, and we'll be ready." When Ole Miss turned them loose, Mercer and Thomas packed up the dog and their shorts and headed for the island. Larry had finished the repairs to the cottage, and Mercer was eager for a week away from the classroom. She was also excited about her first book party since Leo had ruined her last one. For weeks, Bruce had insisted on throwing a major author event and wouldn't take no for an answer. The paperback of Tessa had just been released, and Mercer had signed on for another grueling summer tour to promote it. Bruce insisted that the first stop be at Bay Books and harangued the publisher into underwriting half of it. The party began on Saturday afternoon with barbecue and a bluegrass band on the sidewalk and street in front of the store. The locals needed some fun, and the crowd was large and continued to grow. At 3 p.m., Mercer took her spot downstairs behind a table with stacks of books all around her and greeted her admirers. She chatted them up, posed for dozens of photos and selfies, autographed the paperbacks and some hardbacks as well, held a couple of babies, signed the cast on a broken arm, answered questions from people who claimed they knew Tessa, did a quick interview with the island's newspaper, and all in all, had a delightful time being the popular author with a long line of fans snaking out the front door. When Bruce wasn't working the crowd and selecting other titles for certain preferred customers, he and Thomas and Bob Cobb sat outside on the balcony and sipped tequila. The music switched to reggae late in the afternoon, and the air was filled with soothing music and plenty of laughter. Benny's oyster truck arrived at 5, and a crew began shucking on the side street. Two kegs of beer materialized from somewhere and attracted the faithful. It was springtime, and the weather was perfect.
At 6, Mercer moved upstairs where 100 folding chairs had been arranged for her reading. 3 years earlier, during her brief sabbatical on the island, she had attended several author talks in the same space, and at the moment she couldn't help but remember the twinge of jealousy she had felt for those touring writers who were publishing, selling, and drawing crowds. Now it was her turn at the podium. Lee and Myra were in the front row, as always, and they beamed at her like proud grandparents. Lee appeared ready to cry. Next to her was Amy Slater, the vampire girl, present with her husband and all 3 kids. Andy Adams stood in a corner with a diet drink and smiled at Mercer. Jay Arkelrud, the sour poet, was in the second row and looked out of place as always. Mercer was certain that Bruce had threatened him to compel his attendance. His last book, a thin collection of incomprehensible free verse poems, had sold only 1,000 copies across the country. Bay Books was responsible for half of them. If Bruce wanted a favor, Jay couldn't say no. Back in the good old days, before Leo, the store hosted several author events each week. Some of the writers were popular with large followings that made for easy draws, but others were the rookies or mid-list authors wanting desperately to sell more, and for them, Bruce guaranteed a crowd. He did so by calling, cajoling, charming, and strong-arming his friends and loyal customers. To him, a small turnout was a crushing defeat, one he simply couldn't tolerate. And he was determined to make Mercer Mann a success. He admired her as a writer and adored her as a person, and with her he dreamed of doing something he had never fully accomplished, to make her a literary star, one who could slay the critics while selling books. He, Bruce Cable, wanted to be responsible for her greatness. No one knew this, not even Noelle, though she knew he was quite fond of Mercer. She had the talent, but he wasn't sure about the drive, the ambition. She smiled at Bruce and Thomas near the back and began her talk. She was delighted to be back, as always, and impressed with the resiliency of the island. It had been 6 months since her last visit, and she marveled at the recovery. She was grateful for the thousands of volunteers and hundreds of nonprofits who had rushed down to help. She switched gears and talked about her summers on the island. Every summer, from the age of 7 through 19, she stayed with Tessa, her beloved grandmother. Her parents were divorced. Her mother was ill. For 9 months, she suffered at home in Memphis with a father who had no interest in her. She begged him to let her live with Tessa permanently, but he wouldn't yield. Thomas watched and listened with enormous pride. He had accompanied her the previous summer on her 34-stop book tour, and he had heard these stories at least as many times. Her transformation, though, had been remarkable. Never timid, she had gone from being a chatty speaker who ran out of things to say after 30 minutes to a seasoned raconteur who could tell the same story 3 different ways and draw tears with each telling. By the end of the tour, no audience wanted her to stop after only an hour. And Thomas knew a deep secret that one day soon everyone else would know. Mercer was hard at work on her next novel. She had written half of it, and it was brilliant, by far her best work to date. Bruce, of course, had, over drinks, already tried to pry out anything to do with the next novel, and Mercer had warned Thomas about this. So he admitted only that she was working, but keeping it all to herself. She opened up the discussion with questions from the floor, and when it became obvious they might go on for hours, Bruce pulled the plug at 7:30 and said Mercer needed dinner. He thanked her, hugged her, and made her promise to return soon with the next novel. The crowd stood and applauded loudly. Both Lee and Myra were in tears. 6. They walked as a group to the Marchbanks house, 4 long blocks from the store.
Noel, who had sort of enjoyed the first 500 or so book signings, but had long since stopped attending them, was fussing around the kitchen and veranda, waiting for her guests. All went straight to the bar, where Bruce and Noel fixed drinks. Andy Adam finished another diet soda, gave Mercer a hug, and drifted away. After a round or two, Noel called them to order and got them seated. For a second, Bruce flashed back to last August, when his little literary mafia had gathered at the same table. It was their last gathering before Leo, and his friend Nelson Kerr sat right over there, to his left, and seemed to enjoy the evening. 24 hours later, he would be dead. It was Mercer's day, and all talk revolved around her, though she was weary of the attention. Salads were served, wine was poured. The spring air turned chilly, and Bruce lit an outdoor heater. Hours passed as everyone seemed to talk at once. After dessert, Bruce abruptly stood and reached for Noel. As they held hands, he said, "Attention, please. I have an important announcement. Tomorrow evening at exactly 6 p.m., you are invited to a wedding on the beach. Your attendance is not voluntary, but rather mandatory."
"Who the hell's getting married?"
Myra blurted.
"We are." "It's about time."
"Hang on. You see, many years ago, Noel and I got married in the south of France. We were in a small rustic village near Avignon, and we walked into this gorgeous little church that was 500 years old. The place was so beautiful, so awe-inspiring, that we decided on the spot to get married there. So we did. No priest, no paperwork, nothing official. We made up some vows and declared ourselves husband and wife. So for the past 20 years, we've been
living in sin," Myra blurted.
"Something like that. Thank you. And so now we have some paperwork, and we'll have a real minister, and we'll do it the right way. We will pledge our everlasting love and faithfulness to each other." The word faithfulness stunned them. Their jaws dropped, and a couple actually gasped. Was the open marriage finally coming to a close? Was Bruce Cable, playboy extraordinaire and legendary stalker of lonely female authors on tour, finally growing up? Was Noelle finished with her French-style affairs across the ocean? Myra, on a roll and fairly well liquored up, asked,
"Did you say faithfulness?"
The others laughed nervously as they breathed again. "I did."
"That's what I thought. Now, Myra,"
Lee chided. Bob Cobb looked at Myra and cut his throat with an index finger. "Shut up." She did. "We expect you all to be there, on the beach, so shoes are optional. No gifts, please." 7. The caterer pitched a party tent not far from the main pier, which had been rebuilt and christened with a ribbon cutting only a week earlier. Half the island turned out for the party, and politicians spoke for hours. The new pier was a welcome symbol that the famous 12-mile stretch of open and wide sand was now clean and ready for a new future. Under the tent, two clerks from the store, earning double time, poured champagne while soft jazz emanated from hidden speakers. Two waiters circulated with trays of fresh raw oysters and marinated shrimp on skewers. There were about 50 in attendance, and everyone felt honored to be included. All friends, no family. Noelle's parents had divorced years earlier and didn't speak. Bruce's father was dead, and his mother lived in Atlanta, which was not that far away, but dealing with her was not worth the trouble. He was somewhat friendly with his sister, but she was too busy for an impromptu wedding. Noelle was stunning in a white linen pantsuit with the cuffs rolled halfway up to the knees. Bruce, true to form, wore a brand new white seersucker suit with shorts instead of pants. No shoes for either.
At 6:30, as the sun began to fade, they gathered in a semicircle at the water's edge. The officiant was a young Presbyterian minister from the island who had worked in the store through high school. In bare feet, he welcomed the friends and offered a prayer, followed by a verse from 2 Timothy. Bruce and Noel exchanged vows they had written, the crux of which was that they were renewing their love and devotion and basically dedicating themselves to a new lifestyle, one in which they were completely committed to each other. It was over in 15 minutes, and once pronounced husband and wife, Bruce pulled out a sheet of paper, the marriage certificate, for all to see as proof that this time they were properly hitched. The wedding party then returned to the tent for more champagne and oysters. 8. The second yellow envelope arrived with Tuesday's mail. Bruce stared at it for a long time. No return. A pre-printed mailing label was addressed to him at the store, and remarkably, a postmark dated yesterday from the Santa Rosa post office across the street. So he was here, Bruce said under his breath, and probably in the store. He thought about taking a quick photo of the envelope, but then changed his mind. Everything was hackable, right? If the bad guys were watching and listening with sophistication far beyond his comprehension, then why couldn't they steal his photos? He slowly opened the envelope and removed one folded sheet of paper, the same color yellow. The typed message read, "Lovely ceremony Sunday afternoon at the beach. Your wife is very pretty. Congratulations. Snail mail, email, it all leaves a trail. There are serious people watching your every move. They killed Nelson. They killed Brittany. They are desperate men. Bullet beep, a chat room, tomorrow at 3 p.m. You'll be 88 Dogman. So long, Houdini 36. Bruce was certain that in his 47 years, he had never felt as though he was being watched or followed or observed, especially by people whose interests he did not share. He left the store, something he did at least 4 times a day, and stepped onto the sidewalk along Main. He could almost feel the lasers of someone's surveillance locking in on his back. He stood straighter, walked with a purpose, tried his damnedest not to cut his eyes in all directions, and after 50 yards, called himself an idiot for being so paranoid. What could anyone gain by watching Bruce Cable walk down Main Street in Santa Rosa, Florida? He ducked into his favorite wine bar and ordered a glass of rosé. He sat in his favorite corner with his back to the door and studied his notes. Why would he mention Noel? Was it a way of threatening Bruce? It certainly felt like a threat. Was he friend or enemy? No one outside Bruce's circle knew about the wedding, right? How would he know to be at the beach at the right moment? Bruce had not mentioned the ceremony to anyone in an email or text. And how could he get close enough to Noelle to know she was very pretty? Bruce had been occupied with his bride and the party at hand and had not bothered to glance around at the beachcombers. There were always people on the beach, but not many on a cool late afternoon in mid-March. He didn't remember seeing anyone. If they were listening to his phone calls and reading his emails, for how long had they been at it? He recalled when he first contacted Elaine Shelby. He did so by phone. She immediately warned him against using emails. He then flew to Washington and met Lindsay Wheat. Was it possible that they knew he had hired a private security firm to find Nelson's killers? It seemed doubtful, but then with technology, what was not possible? He puzzled and pondered and took pages of notes, none of them revealing or helpful. He ordered another glass of rosé, and the second one proved as ineffective as the first. 9. With Nick away at school, Bruce's favorite employee was Jade, a 30-year-old part-timer with 2 college degrees and 2 toddlers at home. She was still looking for a career, but in the meantime, thoroughly enjoyed the flexible hours Bruce offered. She was a tech whiz, addicted to social media, knew the hottest and latest apps, and was contemplating a graduate degree in computer science. Without getting too specific, Bruce asked her to walk him through the scenario of corresponding through anonymous chat rooms. He fibbed and said such activity was a subplot in Nelson's novel, and he wanted it to be accurate. He knew it was quite unlikely Jade would ever read it. She took a seat in his office and said,
"Bullet Beep is just another secret chat room based in Bulgaria. Most are in Eastern Europe because privacy laws are tighter there. Crazy Ghost is based in Hungary. I found 3 dozen of these sites in half an hour. They're legit, for a fee. Most are around $20 for 30 days.
"Can they be hacked?" Bruce asked.
"In my opinion, it would be very difficult for someone stalking you to read your messages on one of these sites."
"Why not? Let's assume I've been hacked as of now, and they're reading my mail. When I log in and go to Bullet Beep or whatever, they're watching, right?"
"To a point. Once you pay up and become a member, for lack of a better term, your messages are instantly encrypted and protected. They have to be, or these sites couldn't work. They have to guarantee complete anonymity."
"And they're popular?"
"Who knows? It's all secret. I mean, I never use them, and I don't know anybody who does, but then I'm not having an affair or selling arms or doing whatever Nelson was up to in his novels."
"Thanks." She left, and Bruce waited and waited. At exactly 3:01, he went to Bullet Beep, followed instructions, paid with a credit card, which was also being watched, he presumed, and said hello as 88 Dogman. He was already tired of the silly names. "Hello, Houdini 36. I'm here."
"Good afternoon. How's married life?"
"The same. Why did you mention my wife?"
"I don't like that."
"I shouldn't have. Sorry."
"Friend or foe?"
"I'm not sure."
"Brittany was murdered. Would the enemy tell you this?"
"Yes, if the enemy was trying to scare the hell out of me."
"You need to be scared."
"So am I.
May I suggest a destination for the honeymoon?"
"Oh, go ahead."
"New York City.
I'm there on business next week. We really should meet face to face. There is so much to cover."
"And what will we cover? And where is this going? What's the end game?"
"You want Nelson's killer?"
"Only if no one else gets hurt, including me. I can walk away right now."
"Don't do that. They will not walk away. They don't want his book published. They being Grattan, right?"
There was a long pause as he waited and gawked at the screen. He took a deep breath and tapped his fingers beside the keyboard. Finally,
"I think you just gave me a heart attack. Sorry, didn't mean to. Look, I know some things, obviously, and I'm tired of these little chat rooms and silly names. Are we going to meet and have a serious discussion?"
"New York, next week, honeymoon. I'll be there on business."
"Any particular hotel?"
"The Lowell on 63rd. I'll find you."
10. After 2 days and nights at the Lowell with no contact, Bruce was privately bitching about Manhattan hotel prices and thinking of leaving. To make matters worse, Noelle was shopping out of boredom. Whatever the reason, the prices were high and the boxes were piling up. Bruce had lunch with Nelson's editor, and he had drinks with an agent, and he hung out in a couple of his favorite bookstores. But he was tired of the city. On the third day, Noelle was having tea in the hotel bar when an attractive brunette stopped at her table and said,
"You're Noelle, right?"
The eye was flat, as in North Florida.
"I am."
She handed over a small envelope, yellow.
"Please give this to Bruce."
And she was gone. Bruce read the note.
Meet me in the second floor bar of the Peninsula Hotel on 55th at 3:30 p.m. I'll be alone. They arrived early and the bar was empty and dark. Noel took a table close to the counter, ordered a seltzer, and began reading a news magazine. Bruce went to the rear with his back to the mirrors and a full view of the bar. At 3:30, the same brunette sauntered in like a fashion model, noticed the couple was not together, and walked to Bruce's table and sat down. Without offering a hand, she said, "I'm Danielle." "Also known as Dane?" Bruce asked calmly, and she couldn't conceal the shock. She exhaled as her shoulders dropped and all pretense of being cool and in charge vanished. She flashed a fake smile and glanced around. Perfect teeth, high cheekbones, lovely brown eyes, a bit too much padding in the forehead, but all in all, one good-looking woman. Tall, slender, decked out in designer stuff. Very classy.
"How'd you know?"
"A long story. One of many. I'm Bruce. We weren't expecting a woman."
"Sorry to disappoint. Look, I'd feel better if we had more privacy. I have a room on the fourth floor."
"I'm not going to your room, because I'm not sure what I'd find there."
"You'll find nothing."
"If you say so. Noel and I are happy to invite you to a room we have on the sixth floor."
"Very well."
They rode the elevator with three strangers, so not a word was spoken. Once safely inside the room, they managed to relax as they sat around a small coffee table. With a flair, Bruce began with, "Well, I'm Bruce Cable, small-town bookseller from Camino Island, Florida. This is my wife, Noelle, peerless importer of antiques from the south of France." "And you are?"
"Danielle Nodden, Houston, Texas, and I have a lot of questions."
"So do I," Bruce said. "How did you know about our wedding ceremony on the beach?" She flashed a warm smile, and Bruce almost melted.
"I was on the island with a friend, just a few days at the beach. I wanted a closer look at you and your turf. When we were in the store, we overheard a conversation about the ceremony, so we just happened to stop by. It's a small town, and I guess people talk too much."
"That's certainly true," Noel said.
"I'm sorry, I didn't mean to frighten you. I mentioned it so that you would take my letter seriously."
"Oh, I did," Bruce said. "We're not playing games here."
"No, we're not. Why did you know I'm called Dane?"
"We went through Nelson's stuff after the police were finished. There wasn't much. Virtually all of his notes and research were evidently in his computer and heavily encrypted. But there were three notebooks with all sorts of random chicken scratch. Notes on the best dive lodges in Bermuda, restaurants in Santa Fe, a three-page story idea for a novel, one that went nowhere because the idea was not good, a few phone numbers that the police checked out and got nowhere, that sort of stuff. But there were four references to a Danielle, who was also called Dane. I take it you guys met once in San Antonio." She shook her head in disbelief.
"We did."
"The police paid no attention to it. No surprise there."
"Where is their investigation?"
"Still open, but they found little. Coffee, anyone?" Noel nodded, and Dane said,
"That would be nice."
Bruce stepped to the phone and called room service. Noel asked her softly,
"You're in the city often?" "Twice a year. The usual shopping in Broadway and a new restaurant or two with some girls from Houston."
It was obvious Dane had expensive tastes and lived well. Noel pegged her age at 41 max. Bruce returned to the sofa and asked, "Now, where were we?"
"How much do you know about Grattan?"
Dane asked. "Well, everything that has been written about a company that works extremely hard at revealing nothing. Basic corporate structure, sales figures, number of facilities, a few names of the big boys, and a lot of bad press about nursing home abuse. The company seems to relish staying in trouble."
"The company relishes making money, and it's very good at it. Does the name K Ken Reed ring a bell?
It's his company, CEO and chairman.
When Ken was about 30 years old, his father died in a plane crash, and he inherited a string of cheap nursing homes in Texas and Oklahoma. He learned the business, spruced up his facilities, and began expanding. He was and still is very ambitious. Now he's 62, rich, and still works 7 days a week.
Do you work for him?
I sleep with him. I'm wife number 3. First, I was his secretary / assistant / girlfriend. He got tired of wife number 2, and I got the big promotion. Now he's looking for number 4. The man will never have enough money or women. He's more than happy to get me out of town. It's never been a healthy marriage, and it will soon be over.
Forbes puts his net worth at $600 million.
No one knows. He buries it here and there, does a lot of offshore banking, runs money through a maze of corporations. He's paranoid about his privacy and cheats like hell on his taxes. Not your typical rich Texan who can't wait to show off his money. There's always somebody richer down there, so he doesn't play that game.
Why will the marriage soon be over?
She smiled again and looked out the window.
We don't have enough time.
You brought it up. We can talk about something else.
She offered him a soft gaze, but the beautiful eyes were focused, almost glaring.
When I was 20, I got a job as a secretary with a company in Tulsa that owned some nursing homes. Ken bought the company and came through one day. I caught his eye, primarily because his eye is always roving. I got a promotion I didn't deserve and was transferred to Abilene, where I got another lucky promotion and a one-way ticket to Houston, where his company was headquartered. It was called West Abilene Care back then, later merged with Grattan, and Ken liked that name better. His name is on nothing but his car titles and land deeds, and not all of them. Anyway, when I got to Houston, he was waiting. He offered me the job as his executive assistant at a generous salary, and before long we were companions. This went on for about 5 years. He finally paid off number 2, and I became number 3. That was 14 years ago. I worked hard, took my job seriously, learned everything about the company, most of which I'd like to forget, by the way, and kept up with the technology. Over time, Ken began to worry that I knew too much, so he forced me into retirement to get me out of the office. But I was quite unhappy sitting around the house. I refused to have children with him, which has proven to be a wise decision, and I insisted on a job, something meaningful. He resented this, but finally agreed. Not long after I returned to work, I learned that he had a serious new girl in Dallas. This was no surprise, really, because he has never stopped philandering. So, I've played the game myself. Not exactly an open marriage, but it's kept me sane.
Bruce looked uncomfortably at Noel, who ignored him. The term open marriage brought back memories.
And you met Nelson?
Bruce asked. She smiled seductively at her own memories.
I did. I liked him a lot. Obviously, you've read his last novel?
Read it, edited it, sold it.
Well, folks, the novel is true, and the story is about Grattan and its secret drug. When I decided to squeal, snitch, blow the whistle, call it what you want, I decided to go to Nelson Kerr. I had read an interview with him in which he talked about his work and his research into shady conspiracies and such. I reached out, we met, hit it off in a fine way, and began a relationship.
Go, Nelson, Bruce said.
Come on, Bruce,
Noel scolded.
It's okay, Dane said. We were very fond of each other, and I feel responsible for his death. If he hadn't met me, he would still be alive.
We're leaving out entire chapters here, Bruce said. There was a knock on the door, and Bruce opened it. A porter set the coffee service on the table, and Bruce signed the check. Noel poured as Bruce locked the door. They fiddled with their sugar and cream for a while. Dane said,
A question.
Can the novel be stopped?
No way, Bruce said. That's where they screwed up. They didn't know that Nelson was finished with it when they took him out. I've sold the book and it's coming next year, in a big way. If we can prove he was murdered because of it, they won't be able to print them fast enough. A question for you. How did they know about Nelson and his research?
He went to China and found the lab. I told him not to go, just as I told him not to dig too deep. Just take the story, fictionalize like crazy, and write a novel. That wasn't good enough for Nelson. He wanted to know all the dirt. Somehow, somewhere in the underworld, word got out that Nelson Kerr, a best-selling author, was writing about a nursing home company and its mysterious drug.
Was the Chinese lab involved in his death?
I doubt it. It's a huge pharmaceutical over there that makes all manner of illegal and semi-legal drugs. They don't care, and they're immune from prosecution and liability. They make fentanyl, even meth. How much do you know about the drug?
With a bit of showmanship, Bruce pulled a small plastic bag out of his pocket and tossed it on the table. Inside were three clear capsules filled with a brown substance. There is the mysterious vitamin E3, guaranteed to keep you ticking, even though you can't see a damn thing and you're puking up your guts. Dane's jaw dropped as she gawked at the pills in disbelief. They watched her as she tried gamely to be stoic while her mind went crazy. She breathed deeply and said,
"I've never seen the drug. How on earth did you get it?"
"It's a long story that we don't need to discuss. But Grattan has 300 facilities in 15 states, so there's a lot of this stuff in the pipeline and in play. It wasn't that difficult to lift a few capsules."
"How'd you know about the side effects?"
"We ran it through some high-end labs where it was finally identified as Flaxacil. We've done some work, Dane."
"Indeed you have. Was this by chance found in Flora, Kentucky?"
"It was. By Brittany, who is no longer with us. You feel responsible for Nelson's death. We feel responsible for Brittany's."
"Don't. Brittany was killed by the same people who took care of Nelson."
"The boys at Grattan?"
"Yes. I wasn't in the room, but I'd bet that when Ken Reed and his circle found out that a $10-an-hour orderly in Flora, Kentucky had lifted a bottle of E3, they went into a panic." "These guys kill all the time?"
Noelle asked. Dane tried to relax with a sip of coffee. She gently set down her cup and took two deep breaths.
"These guys, and there are four of them, began as decent men. The money ruined them. They started making millions and figured out ways to make millions more. They provide substandard care at expensive rates, courtesy of the taxpayers. If there's a way to screw Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, Ag, Defense, pick another one, then these guys know how to do it. Have they killed before? Probably, but nothing has ever been proved. Roughly 10 years ago, a federal meat inspector in Nebraska died under suspicious circumstances. One of Reed's offshore corporations owned several meat processing plants in the Midwest, low-end beef and pork they peddled to fast food chains, school lunch programs, even the military. An inspector surprised them with a visit and found plenty of violations. He shut down two plants. The company ran to Washington, lined up the politicians on its payroll, and got them reopened. The inspector would not go away and kept inspecting. He shut them down again and again. He eventually died in a car crash, late at night, on a lonely road.
"Who are the four?" Bruce asked.
"Ken Reed, his cousin Otis Reed, a lawyer, Lou Slater, head of security and bribery, and an accountant named Sid Chenault. Slater is the one to worry about. Ex-FBI, ex-Army Ranger, a smooth operator who always carries a gun. He runs all security, at least around the headquarters. There's not much at the facilities. Cost too much.
He also handles the political side and doles out huge sums of money to politicians above the table and to regulators under the table. Grattan operates on a large scale, so there are a lot of inspectors and bureaucrats to keep at bay. It's far cheaper to pay bribes than to provide quality care.
And these four men make all the decisions?
No, not at all. Ken Reed is the dictator. The other three are like sycophants. They do what he says, make him look good, and never cross him. He demands complete loyalty.
Is there a weak link? Bruce asked.
I doubt it. But then they've never been threatened. Ken pays them a fortune and keeps them happy. I think they would take a bullet for him.
Who's the youngest?
Sid's about 45. Happily married with 5 kids still at home. Clean-cut, devout Baptist, a country boy from somewhere around Waco. Last time I checked, his salary was almost $1 million a year. That buys a lot of loyalty.
How much access do you have? Noel asked.
More than they know. When I was Ken's executive assistant, I knew virtually everything. He became uncomfortable with that, and I realized it. I know their computers and systems. I don't hack anything, but I still see a lot of stuff they don't know I'm seeing.
And you're still on the payroll?
Vice president in charge of marketing, of which there is almost none. You don't have to advertise in this business.
Do they suspect you? Bruce asked.
No. If they suspected me of talking to Nelson, I wouldn't be here now.
They let those words settle around them. Softly, Dane said,
And it's time for me to leave now. Nelson was killed in August, and since then, there has been a real change in Ken's moods around me. I don't think he feels guilt over the killing, and as I said, I don't think he suspects me. But he is worried sick about being exposed. Sure, Flaxseal is not an illegal drug, and sure, it actually extends life. But he fears a massive federal investigation into Medicare fraud, with indictments likely. And look at the lawsuits, tens of thousands of them, by the families of the victims, families whose misery was prolonged by the drug. And no insurance company will step forward to save Grattan, not for illegal acts. I need to get out while I can. I hate what the company does, and I despise most of the people who work there. I want a new life.
What's your endgame? Noel asked.
Nelson promised me half the royalties from the book. Nothing in writing. In fact, he made the promise in bed. But for me, it's still binding.
Bruce was shaking his head. It'll be tough to collect from his estate. Alive, he could honor his commitment. But I'm not sure his executrix and the probate judge will go for it. Besides, you can't exactly file a claim in court and expect it to go unnoticed.
That's what I figured. Do you know much about the whistleblower statutes?
Me? I'm just a small-town bookseller.
I doubt that. I need some help. I can't tell the entire story myself because I'm married to Ken Reed, the chief conspirator. I mean, there's no law prohibiting one spouse from ratting out the other, but I just can't do that.
Get a divorce, Noel said. Sounds like you're ready.
I plan to, but it's complicated. Ken would not agree to it right now. He's too paranoid and afraid of my lawyers digging through his dark world. Anyway, there's a prenup in the way, one I signed practically under duress. I get $1 million cash and nothing else. I could probably attack it based on his net worth, but that's another huge lawsuit that would drag on for years. There's also an element of fear involved here. These are dangerous people, obviously. I want to get out and get away.
For the first time, her voice cracked, but just slightly. Then she collected herself, offered them a lovely smile, and drank some more coffee.
Noel asked, How much is all this worth, this huge scam they've been running for how many years? At least 20. So in the past 20 years, how much money has Grattan made off its vitamin E3? Have you read Nelson's novel?
Half of it.
Bruce said he puts the number at $200 million per year in extra Medicare payments. Dane smiled and nodded.
I'd say that's close. Keep in mind that no one really knows because it's impossible to know how long these patients will survive with the drug. One might get an extra 6 months, another might hang on for 3 years.
That's $4 billion total, Noel said.
Give or take. And there's no one to complain. It's a brilliant scheme until it's discovered. I have a hunch that Ken Reed might be ready to stop it. He's made enough, and he might feel some danger.
Because of Nelson's book? Bruce asked.
That. And now a sample has gone missing. All he has to do is snap his fingers, and the E3 disappears. No one will know about it. The staff has no idea what the drug is anyway. The patients will die, but that's what they're supposed to do. Their poor families will be relieved. No one will ask questions.
She glanced at her watch and seemed surprised that she had been there for almost 2 hours.
I need to go. My friends will be waiting. Can I make a suggestion?
She was opening her large purse. She withdrew two small boxes.
These are cheap phones, burners, bought them at Walmart in Houston. Let's use them only for each other, okay?
Sure, Bruce said. When shall we talk again?
Soon. The walls are closing in, and I want to get away from these people.
She stood, and everyone shook hands. Bruce escorted her to the door, closed it behind her, then fell onto the sofa. He rubbed his eyes, then closed them and threw an arm across his forehead. Noel found a bottle of water in the minibar and poured two glasses. She finally asked,
"Do you ask yourself why you're doing this? Couldn't we just as easily go home and close this little chapter, let the police down there do their thing or not, and just forget about Nelson? Why are we expected to solve the murder? As you like to say, he ain't your brother."
"Only about 5 times a day." He sat up and said, "Look, Noel, I don't have to tell you that this is not sustainable. I can't live with one eye in the rearview mirror. Can you believe that we're going about our routines with the belief that someone is listening to our phone calls and reading our emails? I'm just not cut out for this. I'm tired of losing sleep and sick of worrying about who killed Nelson."
"Can you walk away?"
"Of course not. I'm his literary executor, and his novel will be published next year. I'll be dealing with that and his backlist for years."
"I get that. But no one appointed you as his private detective."
"True. And it was a mistake to hire that firm in D.C. and get so involved."
"But it's done. So what's next?"
"We're going to D.C. 11. They left the Lowell in a cab headed for Penn Station, not LaGuardia. Their two seats on the flight would go unoccupied. Instead, they took the Acela Express and 3 hours later rolled into Washington's Union Station, where they hopped in a cab for the long haul to Dulles. Near the airport, they walked into the unmarked building just after 1 p.m., and Lindsay Wheat was waiting. Elaine Shelby joined them, and they gathered in a conference room and kept things polite. Less than 3 weeks earlier, Bruce had stormed out of the building with Nick in tow. Bruce handed over a document and said, "This is your termination letter, which I did not sign."
"Excellent," Lindsay said with a generous smile. "Nice to keep you as a client."
"Maybe. We need some help. And of course, you have been paid in full."
"Indeed, we have."
"One rather significant condition. You do not infiltrate or organize any other scheme to collect information without first notifying me. This is not negotiable." Lindsay looked at Elaine, then looked at Bruce.
"We don't usually make this concession because it can handcuff us later. You see, Bruce, we don't always know exactly where the truth might take us. We have to be flexible, and we often are forced to adapt on the fly.
you also get people hurt, Brittany being one. 3 years ago, you came within minutes of getting Mercer hurt, or worse. You make me this promise, or I'm leaving. Again. Elaine said,
Okay, okay. You have our word.
Everyone took a deep breath. Then Bruce plowed on. We have met the informant, and the informant has confirmed everything we suspected about Nelson, about Grattan, and about its use of Flaxacil or E3. Nelson's math was close, about $200 million a year for the past 20 years. They desperately want to stop the publication of Pulse, and they murdered Nelson and Brittany Bolton. Lindsay nodded along, as if this was what she expected.
Okay, tell us the story.
12. When he finished, Elaine said,
You insist on referring to the informant as the informant, meaning that you don't want to reveal his or her gender. But if he was a man, you'd have no problem referring to him simply as he. Therefore, the informant is obviously a woman.
She smiled at Lindsay, who smiled back. Aren't we smart? Noel was thinking the same. Bruce said, Okay, it's a woman. And she's Ken Reed's former executive assistant, who's now his third wife. She knows a lot. But because she's married to the guy, she is not willing to blow the whistle. She is also scared. You cannot reveal her identity until I say so. Noel said,
She thinks there's an urgency here. The company could simply stop using the drug, and no one would ever know the difference.
You didn't hire us to bust the company. You hired us to find Nelson's killer, right?
Lindsay asked.
Right.
Elaine said, The question is, does one lead to the other? We can't answer that. But we do have a very rough plan, one we put together before the, termination.
Bruce asked, You want to share it with us?
It involves going to the FBI, Lindsay said.
Elaine said,
We have contacts in high places within the Bureau, and if we can convince them of an epic Medicare fraud, we think they'll take it and run, especially with a factual background as unique as this. They'll love it, Lindsay said. I need to make 3 phone calls.
Elaine glanced at her watch and said,
I'm starving. Have you had lunch?
No. Good idea, Bruce replied. Lindsay was on her feet, waving them away.
Go eat. Bring me a sandwich. I'll make the calls.
13. On Lindsay's recommendation, they spent the night at the Willard Hotel on Pennsylvania. The following morning was a perfect spring day, a Friday, and they had been gone for an entire week that they had not planned on spending away from home. They walked 5 blocks to the main entrance of the Hoover Building and met Elaine and Lindsay. Just inside the door, they were scanned, photographed, ID'd, and told to pose in front of a tiny camera to record their facial features. Once cleared, they were met by 2 serious young women who escorted them to a conference room on the 3rd floor.
And who are we meeting with?
Lindsay asked one of the ladies.
Mr. Dellinger.
She closed the door as she left. Bruce and Noel had no idea who Dellinger was, but Lindsay and Elaine certainly did. Lindsay said,
Impressive. The deputy director.
Within minutes, Dellinger swept in with a SWAT team of 5 assistants, all in matching black suits, black shoes, white shirts, and a variety of bland ties. Rapid introductions were made, and all names forgotten in a blur. Dellinger swept his arm at the table, and everyone had a seat. A secretary served coffee as Elaine and Dellinger talked about old friends at the Bureau back in the day. As soon as the secretary left and the door was closed, he looked directly at Bruce and said, First of all, Mr. Cable, thank you for coming forward. I'm sorry about your friend Nelson Kerr. It was a pleasant thing to hear, even if it was completely devoid of any warmth or emotion.
Dellinger looked to his right and nodded at Mr. Parkhill, who lifted some paperwork and plunged right in.
"I'd also like to say thanks. This appears to be an historic Medicare fraud, and we would not have known about it but for you."
Bruce nodded, already tired of their gratitude. Parkhill continued,
"We burned some oil last night and verified a lot of the story that's on the table. Our plans are to begin immediately, at the lowest levels. We'll pick off a few orderlies and nurses at various facilities and collect samples. We'll do this without setting off any alarms in Houston. We'll track down the drug and figure out its distribution channels. Flaxacil has never been approved, so its use in such a widespread scam will probably lead to thousands of violations. That alone could sink the company. At some point, we'll raid the offices, haul away the bad guys, and seize their records."
"What about Nelson's murder?" Bruce asked.
"Could be a tough one. Once we get him locked up, charged, indicted, and all that, we'll start squeezing and offering deals. Usually someone will cave and try to save his own skin. Sid Chenault looks especially vulnerable, with 5 kids at home. At any rate, we'll figure that out when we get there. We know how to be effective when dealing with wealthy criminals who prefer to stay out of jail and keep their toys. Having said that, this company looks to be well-run and in the firm grip of a tough cookie. They may not talk."
Dellinger said, "Obviously, Mr. Cable, it goes without saying that this is extremely confidential."
"Of course.
Who would I tell? Do you plan to correspond with your informant?"
"Maybe. I don't know. Should I?"
"We really need the name of the informant. I can't give that to you without the informant's approval."
"Fair enough.
Now we'd like to ask you a bunch of questions and get your responses on tape, if that's okay."
"Can't wait. Can I ask a question?"
"Certainly," said Dellinger.
"This appears to be a contract killing, so it's federal, right?"
"Probably."
"Can we get the FBI office down in Florida to take charge of the investigation?"
"It's already done."
"Thank you."
"No, thank you, Mr. Cable."
Two of the suits left with Dellinger. Bruce and Noel spent the next 3 hours answering Parkhill's questions about Nelson, his death, his books, his estate, and the stories told by Dane Nodden, the still unnamed informant. When they were finally released at noon, they hustled down Pennsylvania Avenue to 15th Street and the old Ebbett Grill, where they enjoyed a long lunch with Lindsay and Elaine.